Hi, this is Jerry Pippin, and this is one of our shows on ancient mysteries, the Ark of the Covenant. King David, one of his first acts was to build the capital in Jerusalem, and he built a beautiful palace. David made his plans to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Taking 3,000 of Israel's best men, he had the Ark set on a new cart and brought it down from Abinadab's house, where it had been for 20 years. Abinadab's sons, Uzzah and Ahio, drove the oxen hitched to the cart. David and his men went joyfully before it, playing on their harps, cymbals, and tambourines. Suddenly, the merrymaking stopped. Abinadab's son, Uzzah, was dead. One of the oxen had stumbled, and maybe without thinking, Uzzah had reached his hand out to steady the ark. God was so angry to see his command about moving the ark disobeyed that he struck Uzzah dead on the spot. David was very upset. So upset he left the ark at the house of Obed, an Israelite who lived nearby, and sorrowfully took his company back to Jerusalem. After 3 months, David decided to move the ark again. This time, however, he was careful to follow the instructions God gave through Moses. He sent priests down to bring the ark back on their shoulders with poles, saying, "First time the Lord our God broke out against us because we did not consult him about the proper way to move the ark." As they moved the ark, the people offered sacrifices along the way. There was a great celebration when the ark finally reached Jerusalem. David gave all of the people gifts of bread, meat, and raisin cakes. Then priests were appointed so that sacrifices should be offered each morning and evening for the people, just as God had commanded in the law of Moses. Now David decided to build a house for God. "I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside a tent of curtains." For most of us, the Ark of the Covenant story starts there in the Holy Bible. But Frank Joseph has made a lifetime of searching for the real story of the Ark of the Covenant. And he has found leads that have led him around the world to strange names from strange places. Has led him to stories of Atlantis, Nazi Germany, and many other mysterious places. On the line, we have Frank Joseph. And the name of the book, again, Opening the Ark of the Covenant. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on. Okay.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this book. Tell me the background on why you decided to write it.
Well, Opening the Ark of the Covenant is one of those books that the author never decides to write. It just happens in the course of other things. I've been working on this book about the Ark of the Covenant without even knowing it for the past 26 years. What I mean by that is in 1980 I began a series of books on the origins of civilization. And I was not happy with the conventional explanations that civilization began just 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, that there were a lot of very important unanswered questions. And in the course of my research, I kept coming across basic themes over and over again from different parts of the world, different cultures. And these themes all converged on what we know as the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is represented really historically in a single chapter that we know of in the Old Testament.
Most of us know about a little bit about what it's in the Bible, but from what you said, Frank, it sounds like maybe
the references are in numerous cultures around the world, and Ark of the Covenant, the Aron HaBarit as it is in Hebrew, just represents this single object, which the Hebrews knew from about 1200 B.C. to about 600 B.C. only, that it was not invented or built by them, that it's something that they inherited, something that they lost and other people's picked up. And this book that I put together, Opening the Ark of the Covenant, is not a religious book. It just follows this artifact, and that's in fact what it is. It is an artifact, it is an object, which goes back into the depths of prehistory, all the way through the earliest known history right up to the modern time. And it's an enormously huge story, and that's why it's taken 26 years to write, I suppose. And my conclusion, to jump to the end of this thing right away, is that the Ark of the Covenant, what we know, what's described in the Old Testament as the Ark of the Covenant, is, in my opinion, the most valuable object that has ever been possessed by human beings. And that it went under various different names before it came into the possession of the Hebrews and long afterwards. That, in a nutshell, in a very general nutshell, is what opened
up. Yeah, it is an interesting read, and especially when you talk about this. I mean, we hear all kinds of things about the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, does it exist today somewhere?
I have absolutely no doubt that it definitely does exist yet today. One of the things that I was able to determine in my research, which took me around the world, by the way, I should mention at the beginning that I am not a biblical scholar, I'm not an archaeologist, even though I have the presumption to edit an archaeological magazine, Ancient American. My background is in journalism, which I think suits me for this particular investigation, because my job is to determine the truth and not to determine different speculation, find out what really happened. So I think that the Ark of the Covenant it's an object which was reproduced several times, more than just a few times, that the technology that went into making this fabulous object didn't just end in one example, for the same reason that our technology today does not make one space shuttle, but several. So the same thing applies to an ancient technology that made several of these objects that served numerous peoples around the world. That's another one of the shocking things, is that we think about the old world, the ancient old world, as being just composed of, makers of swords and big cities and so on, and that's about as far as it went. But this object represents a solid-state electronic device which was thousands of years, millennia ahead of its time, and that really only in our time can we begin to appreciate just what this object was. And I think that what it was, as I said, an electronic device, a kind of a transducer or a capacitor, which was able to change mechanical energy into electrical energy.
We hear stories about people touching the Ark of Covenant and dying.
Well, it does both. It's the dilemma of technology. Fire can cook your food and warm your house, and it can also burn your house. It depends on how technology is applied. Technology is amoral. It's neither good nor bad. It depends on how it's used. And it's the same thing with the Ark. When the Ark was in its proper setting, such as Solomon's Temple, what it did and what it can still do is that it transmutes mechanical energy into electrical energy. As I said, it also produces huge amounts of negative ions. I'll cut to the chase on this. Negative ions have the capacity to interface with the part of the human brain known as the hippocampus. And the hippocampus has been identified by medical science as, it's being referred to as the God part of the brain. Because if the hippocampus of the brain is stimulated properly with negative ions, the patient or the person so subjected experiences visions, the presence of God, angelic appearances, and so on. This has been repeated thousands, numerous times. And I think that's what this object did. So it's the capacity to interface with human consciousness to instill deep knowing, a deep spiritual knowing far beyond anything that you could get in them.
Immediately visions conjure up in my brain here when you talk about what you just said. It's the fact that who built this to begin with, and why? Is it to expand human consciousness, or what is the principle behind it?
The principle behind it was not a metaphysical purpose. Its original purpose was, this is amazing, I'm describing a machine that has not yet existed in our modern world, but did exist in the ancient world. It was a machine. machine, part of a machine, to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes, that it was a geotransducer. It was placed over seismic areas of the earth with the idea of making civilization in an agriculturally rich area possible, because that same area was prone to seismic activity, and that this device was used to ameliorate, to transmute seismic activity, to diffuse it into harmless electrical discharge. And that's what it did. But at the same time, just as it also did that, it produced a barrage, a tremendous intensity of these negative ions. That's what takes place when this thing happens. And these negative ions happen to interface with human consciousness. Anybody that's within the even proximity, the vicinity of this object, is going to go through a catharsis, an epiphany, a spiritual change. And so it had two purposes, two functions. I believe, I conclude, my impression is that this object had no metaphysical design purposes.
That was one of the unintended consequences or a byproduct.
A byproduct, noticed yeah. afterwards. And that this machine has both a utilitarian, a mundane purpose, and a metaphysical one. And that, when we read in the Old Testament about the Ark of the Covenant, it's primarily as a spiritual one. However, this object can also be abused and turned into a weapon.
That was one of the things I was going to ask. Is there evidence that people have tried to, humankind over the years have tried to make it a weapon?
Well, not only evidence, there's, I think, some of the most convincing testimony in the Old Testament that, in fact, it was. It was used as a weapon of mass destruction, a wonder weapon. When the Israelites left Egypt, here they were, a minority wandering in the wilderness, a minority of Semitic people who not only had no military background, they were just a nation of shopkeepers and pastoral people, shepherds and so on, and they're confronted by outnumbering enemies who, like the Philistines and the Jebusites, who had tremendous military background, and yet the Israelites wiped all these people out, defeated them one after the other. The only explanation of that, and it's explained very clearly in the Old Testament, is they used this object as a superior weapons technology to defeat their enemies. And really, if there's no real precedent in history for this at that time, although there have been precedents since. For example, at the end of World War II, Nazi Germany was almost practically defeated, and then they started building V1s and V2s. They were on the verge of creating the atomic bomb, and they came very close to wresting superiority away from the Allies and achieving victory right at the end of World War II. And I think the same thing applied with the Israelites.
So, in other words, when this thing is used as a weapon, what are we talking about, a death ray or something?
No, what we're talking about is a kind of sonic cannon. It's described very succinctly and clearly in the Old Testament in the first critical battle that the Israelites had with their enemies, and that's the Battle of Jericho. It's described in tremendous detail. Where Joshua, the Israelite commander, lines up all of his people, the entire population, plus he assembles a military band of trumpeters to gather around the Ark of the Covenant just before the walls of Jericho, the city they want to destroy. And on his signal, he tells everybody to make as much noise and shout at the Ark of the Covenant, and at the same time the trumpeters to blow their trumpets. Well, nothing happens except a lot of noise. Okay, he starts over again. It's described that he relocates the Ark of the Covenant. He repositions it. They go through the whole process again. They scream and shout, the trumpets blow, and the walls come tumbling down. Now, there was a woman by the name of Kenyon, a British archaeologist, who only 15 or 18 years ago discovered Jericho, the remains of Jericho, and her find was validated by her peers. One thing that she found very interesting at Jericho, this Gentile city, is that the walls not only were collapsed, they were pulverized. What I conclude, and I think that in the research that I've been able to show, is that this sound that Joshua had directed, concentrated on the Ark of the Covenant, which in fact was this stone or this electronic solid-state device, transmuted that sound, accumulated it as a capacitor, and then discharged it in a specific direction. And was used as a sonic cannon. And sonic cannons exist today. You see them on the street all the time. They're used to break up concrete. The modern jackhammers are used with the principle of sound. And I think that the same thing was appertained in the ancient world. This device, the Ark of the Covenant, refers to the box it came in, as it were. It was so sacred an object, it couldn't be referred to directly. And the gold box that's described in the Old Testament, it was made of acacia wood covered with gold leaf, because gold is a superb conductor, and that what it contained was a single stone. And this stone was a highly crafted quartz crystal, was natural, but at the same time terraformed. It was very clear, and that this crystal had the capacity, just like we make things in Silicon Valley today, to accumulate energy, one form of energy, and then to magnify it and discharge it as another form of energy.
Now, are there stories or evidence or written material or backing up similar incidents with an Ark of Covenant type thing in other cultures besides the biblical history we talked about?
Absolutely. I've got a tremendous amount of background material, and what I've tried to do is really follow the evidence where it leads. I began this book with no preconceived notions or theories. I didn't even know I was writing about the Ark. I was just pursuing some theme. And all I did is I followed the evidence, and the book is just an expression of the bibliography, as it were. The other culture, one of the best to illustrate your question, best to answer your question, refers to ancient Egypt, because this same object existed in Egypt before the Hebrews were able to get it. And in Egypt it was known as the Benben stone, also the Bennu stone. Basically it means the fire stone. Translation of it directly is the Phoenix stone. Phoenix, of course, was a mythological bird that arose from its own ashes every 144,000 years. The stone was also referred to in Egypt as the Stone of Destiny, and it was placed originally in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, and in its proper setting, and that's what it was made for, was placed in the configuration of the Great Pyramid, which was never used as a tomb of the 100 pyramids known throughout ancient Egypt. Not one of them served as a tomb. There has never been found an original burial in any of them. Matter of fact, there was only one burial found in all of 100 pyramids, and that was an extrusive burial that came hundreds and hundreds of years after that pyramid was made. So the Great Pyramid itself was this machine, and that the crystal inside of it was its most important component part. It served as a transducer. It transmuted the seismic activity of the Nile Valley to harmless electrical discharge and made civilization in the Nile Valley possible. The Ark of the Covenant served the same purpose when it was installed in its proper setting in Solomon's Temple atop Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. And whenever the Ark is installed as part of a component part of a much larger device, then it's peaceful, it's not dangerous, and it serves its proper function. It's only when it's removed and is toted around in a box in the Ark that it becomes unstable. And that's why the Israelites eventually no longer used the Ark of the Covenant. It was killing their own people. According to the Old Testament, it says tens of thousands of Israelites were killed by the Ark of the Covenant. And that's because it became a static discharge. You walk across a plush carpet, for example, and you have to touch the doorknob, and there's a spark that jumps between your finger and the doorknob. It's the same thing that worked with this thing. They're hauling it around through the wilderness, and it's collecting random electrical impulses from the ground, and people get too close to it, they establish polarity, and they get killed, they get electrocuted. And that's exactly what's described in the Old Testament.
Do we have any idea what they did with the Ark of the Covenant?
When the Ark of the Covenant was...
It was killing people, or so what they decided to do?
What they decided to do is that it also would, sometimes the Ark is described in the Old Testament as not performing at all. It just would sit there and not do anything. And when that happened, it was captured by their enemies, the Philistines. And the Philistines found it so unstable, they actually returned it to their sworn enemies, the Israelites. They give it back to them.
Take this thing back.
Take that because it's killing us. We don't know how to work it. Well, the Israelites only had a vague idea how to work it. And what happened was, in the Old Testament, it describes the Philistines putting the Ark of the Covenant back on this ox cart. They brought it back to Israelite territory, and the Israelites, they're afraid to touch branches. So they call them the Levites, and the Levites are this group, it's a family, the family of Levi, and they're the only ones allowed to touch it, the only ones allowed to administer it. They're the experts in this thing. And one of their own men, while the ark is being taken back to further into Israelite territory, he steadies the Ark of the Covenant when it's about to fall off the cart. The cart goes over a rut in the rope.
Right, and he touches it and dies, right?
The judge, his name is Uzzah, U-Z-Z-A-H. Yeah. And as soon as he touches, he's instantly killed.
Yeah.
And he's just one example. Here we have the name of this fella, and there are several other examples. So the Israelites eventually put it into a cave where it became mute. They didn't use it. They went on to conquer Jerusalem, and that's when David established a place to make the temple. It was completed by his son Solomon, and it was installed there. As soon as it was installed in the temple of Jerusalem, Israel immediately went into its golden age, and we know Solomon the Wise. That's because this object, if properly used, has tremendous capacities, not only for spiritual revelation, but like opening human potential, and involved in healing. A lot of healing is being done with this thing. So it's a fabulous object. It's almost everything that can be...
Yeah, but Frank, what I'm wondering about is, had they let this thing go, get away from it?
What happened was is that technology then is the same as now. It can be used or abused, as I say. And one of the last Jewish kings of Israel wanted to use the ark entirely for himself and no longer share it with the community. As a consequence, the ark didn't perform properly, and Israel was conquered by the Babylonians in 567 B.C. The Babylonians wanted it. And Nebuchadnezzar II told his generals, you go into Jerusalem and you dismantle that city. You tear down that temple and you find that Ark of the Covenant for me. And the lists, the bureaucratic lists of everything that they got out of Jerusalem still exist. Everything, the Babylonian records are there. And everything is listed, thousands of objects, gold objects and so on, but not the Ark of the Covenant among them. The Israelites, that rather the Levites, priests of the Ark of the Covenant, were able to sink it into a 150-foot deep shaft directly underneath the temple, and it was no longer accessible, no longer even known to anyone for centuries thereafter. And so it escaped capture by Nebuchadnezzar.
Anybody recover it yet?
Well, kind of interesting. There was a group of men known as the Knights Templars. They were established long after the events that we've talked about here by a man, his name was Godfrey de Bouillon. Godfrey de Bouillon was the leader of the Crusades. He conquered Jerusalem for Christianity about 1,000 years ago. And when he did that, he established something called the Order of the Holy Sepulchre. And the Order of the Holy Sepulchre was composed only of his fellow family members, and their chief duty was to find the Ark of the Covenant and to rescue it, to bring it back to Europe. But it had to be in secret because he didn't want the Pope to hold on to it. He believed part of an illegal organization, that the Christianity had strayed so far by this time that the Ark of the Covenant did not deserve to go into the hands of Pope Urban II. So Godfrey established the Knights Templars, and they were selected for their great engineering skills. They sank shafts all through the Temple Mount for almost 10 years. And eventually this one shaft they found coincided with the original shaft that was sunk by the Levites, and they found the Ark of the Covenant and removed it in the year 1127 A.D. And it stayed in Jerusalem for a very short time, only the summer of that year, and was brought to an Italian monastery called the Monastery of Sorborgo. This is in northern Italy. And this monastery was run by a famous gentleman. His name was, later became Saint Bernard. And Saint Bernard worked with the Templars to bring the Ark from Italy into France. And there it was in France for the next 300 years. I'm trying to compress a tremendous amount of history in a very short time.
Yeah, I understand that. So we're up to 1500 or 1600 by now.
No, not really there. Actually, we're talking more like about 1200.
Okay.
And in 1200, what happened with the Templars when they got the Ark is that it had the same transforming effect on them that it had on those before them. And their consciousness was expanded with this is a remarkable thing I've been able to find. They brought it back to France and put it in St. Bernard's Monastery in Sceaux. And while it was in this monastery, they were building a secret private home for the Ark of the Covenant. Secret in the sense that it was hidden in plain sight. They built a magnificent cathedral, the first of its kind. It's called Chartres Cathedral. And while they're building Chartres Cathedral, they established over the entrance, of the northern entrance of Chartres Cathedral, a carving which can still be seen to this day. And the carving shows a European carrying the Ark of the Covenant, transporting the Ark of the Covenant on the back of a cart. And written over the door, the north entrance, the north portal of Chartres Cathedral are the words, "The Ark is here." In the midst of creating the temple, however, St. Bernard was also being affected by the Ark of the Covenant, and he was violating the principles that the Templars had set up, and that was absolute secrecy, that the Ark was not to be disclosed until the proper time, because they were afraid that the Pope and the Pope's forces would seize this priceless object. And so the Templars took it away from Sceaux and began to move it to various castles around France. And in time, they found that it was best if they gave the Ark of the Covenant to an elite group of people, an elite group of Templars, whose job, like the Levites, was only to take care of this object, nothing else. And they called this group the Cathars. It comes from the word catharsis, or purification. Mm-hmm. And the Cathars had this idea of no longer using the Ark of the Covenant, rather putting in the Ark of the Covenant in Chartres Cathedral, because it would have eventually been seized by the Pope. He would have been like Nebuchadnezzar and torn the entire edifice down to get it. So what they did is they created a network of castles all over France, and they would move this object from one castle to another, one step ahead of the Pope's forces. And the Pope eventually became so enraged at this, was now Pope Innocent III, that he launched a crusade. He called it the Albigensian Crusade. He launched it against the Cathars to get the object back. And he involved tens of thousands of soldiers from all over Europe to defeat the Cathars. They were beaten back to their last castle called Montségur, which is on the Spanish-French border in the Pyrenees. Mm-hmm. And at Montségur, there were only 205 Cathars left. 205, and they were surrounded. Their mountain fortress, Montségur, was surrounded by 10,000 French Catholic troops. Eventually, the Cathars could not hold out. They surrendered, but they made surrender terms with the enemy general, the French general. They said, "We just need 48 hours to get our affairs in order," and the French general allowed them that. During that period, four Cathars smuggled the Ark of the Covenant out of Montségur. We even have the names.
Oh, really?
Listed of those four Cathars who brought the Ark of the Covenant out of Montségur. And that is what I've told you all the way up to this point is richly documented. The Middle Ages and the Dark Ages are surprisingly well recorded.
I feel like you're going to say when we got to written history, there's not much history.
No, there's fabulous. There's an abundance. It made it very easy for me.
I mean, in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, you wouldn't think there would be much record, and you're saying there is. And now, but did it change, or is there still records about where the Ark of the Covenant?
The records still all exist. The reason why there are a lot of written records for the Dark Ages is because illiteracy, of course, was everywhere, but you had an elite. The kings always needed their scribes and so on, and they were always there. Every king, every monarch had his literate person, usually a priest, and those records were preserved in monasteries all over Europe, and they still exist. There's no loss, or very little loss, surprisingly. But up to this point, where these four Cathars are able to smuggle the Ark of the Covenant out, is very well documented. For example, we know that these four men, when they got to a peak about a quarter of a mile away, they lit a bonfire so that the Cathars back at Montségur knew that they had properly gotten away with their charge successfully. The 205 Cathars, men and women, one of the women amongst them, Esclarmonde, was a prominent aristocrat of her time, were arrested and taken to the foot of Montségur. put on stakes and burned alive. And that was the fate of Cathars in times of the Dark Ages. Now, the Ark of the Covenant from this point on, interestingly enough, is up to this point, it's very well documented, and it diverges. It goes into numerous different traditions around the world. There's even a very credible tradition in Japan that the Ark of the Covenant was brought after the fall of Jerusalem to a place called Mount Sorgi, or Mount Sword, Sword Mountain. Now, it's not just a modern rumor. It was investigated by Japanese and American historians after World War II. In fact, some of the Japanese historians, even before World War II, began looking into this and found some interesting things, that the Japanese people who live in this remote area of Japan have some Hebrew words in their language, and also some of their ceremonial regalia have ancient Hebrew designs. It's a very interesting story. Other traditions talk about the Ark of the Covenant going to Ethiopia, and there's very strong evidence that there is something like the Ark of the Covenant in Aksum, Ethiopia today. There is a chapel there that only one man has access to, because the entire focus of that society is on the chapel at Aksum, where they believe the Ark of the Covenant exists. There are other credible stories of the Ark of the Covenant being totally destroyed by the Visigoths after the fall of Rome. Now, what do all these stories mean? There are many more, and I trace as many as I can.
Yeah.
These stories indicate they can't all be true, we're told. Only one can be true, but that doesn't seem to be the case. The same technology that made the Ark of the Covenant, as I said, made more than one. In the same regard, that the same technology that made our space shuttle made more than one.
Yeah, hold on a minute. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. And I want to follow that up, because there's all kinds of questions, and you left me hanging there, and you said something very interesting about Ethiopia. I want to follow up as well, so don't go away.
The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com.